Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined as always by the host with the most, the Hall of Famer, Mr. Tony Sager. Tony, how are you, sir?
Hey, great, Sean. Great to be back, and real excited for this episode, one of the favorite topics for us at CIS. We talk a lot about corporate culture.
We sure do. We're also joined by CIS's own Lee Noriega, Executive Director and General Manager. Lee, how are you?
Good. How are you doing today, Sean, Tony? Good to see you. Jerry?
Wonderful. And we're joined by a very special guest, Jerry Gitchell, who had reached out to the podcast to talk about a very, very interesting topic. And this is, if a corporate culture doesn't exist, can a cybersecurity culture exist? So, Jerry, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you for the suggestion. It's a great suggestion and a topic we want to dive into. And I'm going to start with really kind of the simple question. And so, Lee, let me get your thoughts first on what does a cybersecurity culture mean to you? And does it differ from a broader corporate culture?
Yeah, I think there's some inherent differences, but ironically, I think they all are dependent on each other as well. But just to kind of summarize where I differentiate is, I think from a cybersecurity culture, it focuses on the cybersecurity awareness, the practices and the behaviors to protect information assets. And then the corporate culture is more focused on the overall values, behaviors, and social environment of the organization. But again, it's hard to have a cybersecurity culture if you don't have a corporate culture. And vice versa, I think the cybersecurity culture makes up your corporate culture as well.
Interesting. Jerry, what do you think?
That's how this whole started, was I thought, well, what are you going to do if you've got a corporate culture that is obsolete? Many American companies said, well, wait a minute, we already got one of those. Don't we have those? Let's just change the word business and we'll just scribble in the word security and we've all done. We got it done. And the primary difference from my point of view is that business culture is about increasing revenue and profit, and security culture is more about reducing risk. So it's the same thing, but different. In other words, the structure is the same, but the goals are different.
Right. There's a differentiation between the objectives necessarily of certain elements of both cultures when you're trying to necessarily navigate them. And it's an interesting aspect, Tony, because it's one we discuss all the time about an element of a corporate identity through a cultural piece, and also nurturing that culture through what we do as an organization, and then also what we want to achieve necessarily as an objective.
Yeah, I think so, Sean. I've had a long career in this business. It's hard to have a long career in any sort of leadership job without being a culture watcher. You have to kind of keep an eye on things because, as Lee said, there's no plaque on the wall is the culture. It represents something, but it's culture comes down to what do people value? What do they believe collectively, right? What drives behaviors? What behavior is rewarded either implicitly or explicitly within the company? And so you don't get to, write a happy slogan or a list of things. I think of culture as an emergent property of, for example, leadership behavior. Such things usually start with the top, right? How does it, people see what is valued at the company, what gets rewarded, what gets corrected. And so, we live in the crosshairs here of the issue that Jerry brought up, because we have a strong corporate culture and ours is affected by things like our nonprofit status. That has meaning to us, but we're also a security company. So we inevitably have to try to juggle both of those, right? Because for us, security is not, is more than a business imperative. It's also our reputational risk. If we mess that up, we're just in a bad spot. So I think, having watched organizations struggle with these these culture issues. The biggest mistake I've seen, and Leah, you know, you have a equally long experience in this industry, is where the boss, I remember, and this is actually a true story, there was a big culture issue in one of the places I worked at the National Security Agency, and the boss turned to one of his direct reports and said, you know, after seeing surveys and so forth, "I think we have a culture problem. I'm putting you in charge of fixing it." And okay, I know where this is going. And sure enough, you know, it never achieved those lofty goals. But so what about the role? You know, Lee, you've run companies, right? So you have to set the tone and establish that cultural, you know, viewpoint of what people. Any thoughts on how did you, you know, what were you thinking about there? Your awareness of it, or what did you do to help drive corporate culture?
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting the last 30, 40 years in this space, watching cybersecurity cultures try to grow. And I think the common theme that I've seen over the years is that it really is a top-down approach. It has to be supported by the C-suite, the CEO. If it doesn't, it just creates chaos within the organization. And it also inhibits, you know, opportunities to grow their cyber program. So coming from the other side, you know, in sales, looking to sell into those organizations, I always got adoption from the CIO and from the IT managers of what we were trying to do. But when it came down to signing the contract, which was in the CEO, he's like, "Oh, we don't need this now because it's not within our budget." So again, the top down was really the embryo of creating a great security culture. Now, unfortunately, it's only been maybe the last 10 years that the C-suite community has stood up and taken note, because it's become an important board topic now, you know, cybersecurity. So there's a lot more emphasis put on it. There's a lot more budgeting that's going into it. And I think that's why we're seeing the culture change. And also because the attack vector has changed so dramatically that you have to create that security culture, or you're just prime pickings for the next cyber breach or cyber attack.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Oh, I'm sorry, Tony. Go ahead, please.
Oh, no. You know, one of the reasons Jerry reached out to us, right? Because I think you've seen examples, Jerry, of, I'll call it weak culture, or you don't have that top-down focus. And then that leads to...
How do you spell that?
and then you don't have the focus on either the company's culture or it results in the lack of a security culture. But, you know, any stories from the road about the either strong or weak emphasis that you've seen in the folks that you deal with?
How about the morning news? From the morning news, one of our examples, I came up with three. I'm just going to give you one, though. What's going on over at Amazon? Everybody's got to go back to the office. Not that that's good or bad. I know why they're doing it. All of us probably have the inside story on what's going on over there. But that's so odd to say, wait a minute, I know we did this and we had to do it, but now we're going to turn around and we're going to do it differently. We're going to do it completely differently. But what I've found is true is an organization who still in this day and age has an org chart shaped like a triangle, a pyramid. And not only that, but it's an upside down pyramid. And it's like, we cannot move so slow that we can have just one person at the top making all those decisions. We need to have people on board making it happen now. And that needs to be responsibility. I know we're going to talk about that. And I know that's one of Lee's important elements. We have to change the way we do it. You know, the end user, what the end user brought to the table was yellow stickies. They're the ones that got us to write down all of our passwords on yellow stickies. That has been their contribution. There needs to be more.
Definitely needs to be more. I think it's the, and I think you're absolutely right, Jerry, in terms of the exemplified approach is one, and Lee, we'll go into the responsibility piece just in a quick second here. Because I think it's so important that when we are setting up respectfully a culture, there's necessarily a feedback loop into that culture for ultimately its success. Now, Lee, I'll mention a tone at the top in terms of necessary responsibility as that percolates through an organization. But how is important is it that you get the necessarily that feedback loop into the organization so that, one, you're setting a tone that represents that organization versus just a dictatorship and representatively there is no culture, it's just rules. And I think there's a difference there. What do you think, Lee?
No, I agree. I think that the feedback loop is so important because it's the same methodology that we use to test anything, right? We test, verify, change we have to, and then repeat. Part of that is it's also it provides a learning environment for the CEOs and the C-suites to understand that what they believe is perception from a top down may not truly be what's happening in the company today. I think Jerry brought up an interesting point, and that's when remote workforces, I tend to see companies right after COVID that moved to that remote from home workforce. The security culture kind of, if you had a graph, it probably dipped down quite a bit because people didn't care. You know, they had the perception that I'm home, no one's looking over my shoulder. Maybe the company didn't have the tools in place to get everything implemented for a remote workforce at that time. And so even companies that have moved to that have had a hard time really adopting a good security culture. I have to commend CIS because coming into the company a little over a year ago, I was really surprised at the strong security culture that was built even with almost a total remote workforce. And that's something you don't see very achieved across the board very much. So that was interesting. But again, security programs need to always be evaluated. I mean, there's new things that come up. There's new compliance and regulations. GRC plays a big part in this. Also, you know, as you move people into key roles, you may be introducing more risk. And so that may change your security awareness program at your company as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Jerry, when we think then of, I'll call it out, and you let me know if I'm going down the right path, but it's, there is an element of that compliance, but then there is a shared responsibility for culture. It's not just set for an organization. It's absorbed and built upon. Would you agree with that or add any thoughts there?
I found that COVID demonstrated that we had the ability. Locally in Duval County, Jacksonville, Florida, I found that the teachers, nobody else, the teachers got a remote learning platform up and running in 4 days. And Lee, you're absolutely correct. There are places where people decided to go home and slack off, but not in that group. Those people were committed to making it happen. And what I found happened over the course of the first year, if you remember how bad the first year was that people felt, and I'm not going to use the cliche empowered, they just made stuff happen. And to the way I was thinking, this is how it should be. It's about not shared responsibility, even though we use that term, it's personal responsibility. For too long, we've allowed everyone to say, oh yeah, those are the end users. And you know, they make mistakes and they click on phishing and all of that. But that's not their fault, even though it is their responsibility. It's the corporate responsibility. You know, there's a reason why it's not management we're talking about. It's leadership. And that's where it starts.
Interesting. Interesting. I mean, we see that, Tony, right, in our space with not only in thought leadership, but respectfully from our own leadership and your leadership and Lee's leadership, as we see that permeate the organization. And I love the personal responsibility piece, Jerry. That's very important. But anyway, Tony, what do you think?
Yeah, some of this, those are good examples, Jerry. And yes, because one issue we've been hinting at here is the effect of external or social conditions, right, on corporate culture. So, you know, for like a lot of companies, the need for speed is really a big deal, you know, and that's true of Amazon and everybody else. Well, speed requires, right, to deal with it, you need to do some of the things you mentioned, right? You need to mobilize people, right, so that they take charge of their part of the enterprise. And we don't wait for the top down or the bottom up or the, you know, we have to coordinate across 100 different line organizations to make a step. So you have to kind of manage to the problem. And that both, when you see the reaction of culture, sometimes it reveals the culture, right? It could degenerate just as easily into chaos. And so you got the examples of people who, you know, go home and you know, maybe don't deliver all the value that they could. And then you gave the example of those that did. And so for me, I've been thinking about a phrase that was sort of common when I grew up in the government, which was institutional ownership. Can you have a workforce that feels ownership of the institution or the mission? And I think we have that at CIS, right? There's a strong sense of that, that the institution will outlast any one of us. And therefore, you know, in the healthy organizations I've been in, people often take actions that they don't believe, they don't know will pay off in their time with the company, but they know it's the right thing to do, right? Because it is, and it, I attribute that to this feeling of ownership. That is, you'd like to create this feeling in your workforce. Teachers, for example, are often united by mission, right? They go into that field, not randomly, but because they really care about education and, you know, and the role of children in society and how to bring them up in a particular way. So ownership, and this is something I've been thinking about. Lee, maybe I'll let you take a cut at this, because in a time where people change jobs dramatically more frequently than they used to, and the world around us is swirling, how do we think about institutional ownership? Is it still necessary? Or what is it we can do to help people, even for the time that they're with us, to make the kind of decisions that both advance the current progress, but also the institution over the long haul?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you really want to build a true cybersecurity culture within an organization, you really have to focus on shared responsibilities, because it's not up to just one department. You know, it's not up to the IT department. It's not up to the information security office. It's really, there's a part to play by all people. I think one of the ways that you kind of roll that out is really policies and procedures. And I say this so much because within policies, I was really floored when I was in the commercial sector about how many companies didn't have policies, procedures, and or they were not very mature. And a lot of them, especially when you looked at their security plans, it was all the security policies lumped into one document, which I just thought was, it gets very easy as things change for things to get missed. But that also, you know, also includes identifying security champions within your organization, people with within certain, whether it's in finance, whether it's in sales, whether it's in ISO, there are going to be those champions. And hopefully it's part of the executive leadership team that's really driving that down, because that is crucial in just getting effective movement in all these programs. The leadership commitment, you know, that they're going to really abide by what they're trying to do. And then role-specific training, I think, plays an important part, because not everybody has to be trained to the same level of everybody at the company, right? We don't expect all of our employees to be like CISSPs, but we do expect them to know a certain level of basic security requirements, like email phishing, things like that. And then really, I think the one that we're focused on today at CIS is really integrating security into processes. As we go through our day-to-day jobs, how should we be looking at it? It's almost like a security by design, but really for processes. If we're going to do this, how's this going to change our security posture as a company? And how's it going to change our culture as we go through with this? So those are just a few of the ideas I have around that. But I do believe it is a shared responsibility. It's not up to one organization or one department within an organization to make those changes.
That makes a lot of sense, because when we, and Jerry, the one thing I want to pick up on that, and Lee, 100% with you right there, is when we think about bringing and I'll say establishing security champions, I think it's less about just, you know, we've brought somebody into an organization, we provided them training, here's, oh, you're now part of the security culture. I think it's a little bit different, right? That's kind of the compliance checklist of being part of necessarily a security implementation strategy. Jerry, what do you see when you want to encourage or at least foster cybersecurity consciousness within an organization that people will become security champions and can necessarily self-motivate, right? Get to, you know, we'll do Maslow's hierarchy, get up to, you know, a level of self-actualization that they can contribute more than just being a person within an org. What do you think?
Well, as a former Navy CB, I've served my time. Matter of fact, I've served at Fort McHenry, not too far from where Tony's office used to be, over by the airport. Yeah, I don't know what that building's inside of it, but It's got a nice shiny exterior.
My lips are sealed here, Jerry. Carry on.
When I had an opportunity to work with a mill to sill operation in San Diego, California, where Spar Wars is. You've probably heard of that before. And what we learned, it was called CyberHive. And the very first thing we did was say, what we need is we need more than just the top guy. We need somebody more than just Lee's great, but he's just one guy. And what we really need is we need a small platoon level, I'll say it that way, a squad level of champions who would then work one-on-one with, this is what people like us do things like this. Now that's straight from Seth Godin. People like us do things like this. And that's where culture starts. It's a one-on-one sharing, or as the shared responsibility, in my opinion. I agree with you, Lee. We have to have more than just one person. And it's funny because what Seth does in his, he says we need three stories. The first story we need is the story of me. This is what it means to me. The second story is the story of we. People like us do things like this. I'm here. Are you here also? And that's where the champions come in. Finally, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, in a minute, it's the story of now. And if there's nothing more important to cybersecurity, it is the story of now. So yeah, I absolutely, you know, if you really want to get this thing to move, it cannot be the Department of Culture, even though I'm sure that's what Tony had, the Department of Culture, right, over at NSA. But it can't be, oh, those folks over there. It can't. It has to be within. It has to be embedded, as we talked about.
Yeah. I love the story piece. And the best storyteller I know, Mr. Tony Sager. So, Tony, over to you, sir.
Well, that I'll follow on from that story of the boss, you know, who was frustrated by the challenge. And this was a big deal, mid-90s. And he got a sense of, right, pushback from the workforce. And it was, we have a culture problem. And he turns to his direct report. So I'm putting you in charge of it. And he kind of missed the memo, right, the reading that Jerry talked about here, which is, you know, at the end of the day, no policy, no well-intended poster, you know, no sloganeering replaces how people view the role of the leader. And from there, they will derive kind of the behavior, right? And you'll, you know, in the best case, you'll develop the champions that say, I get what the boss is trying to achieve. I see what they value. And I know how to translate that into action. And there are some people that sit on the sidelines and say, I'll wait for them to tell me what to do. But you're looking for those people that say, you know, that are grateful, you know, that... you know, it's even if you don't, I'll say, like them in a personal level or believe in them, you should always listen to what the boss has to say, right? At every town hall, at every group meeting, because you're getting insight into what they value. And you should, you know, you should do that. I always tell, you know, the young folks, never miss that opportunity. Right, wrong, indifferent, it's important to understand, because that allows you then to say, how does my work reflect or not reflect that? And to take that role on, right, that champion role, because then, you know, you're looking for the leaders, right, people that don't need to be told minute by minute what to do, but who will take it and say that makes sense. So I think, you know, that story, by the way, how did that story work out? Not really well. You know, we had name tents, or we had little table tents with slogans and things that hang on the doors and, you know, slogans and buttons and all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, if people didn't believe, there was no amount of that can overcome this belief, you know, that either the boss didn't mean it or I don't know what they meant. And so we really kind of got stuck in the mud on that part of it. NSA, you know, Jerry, as you hinted, was a very culturally conscious institution. And that I get what I gave you was a bit of an anomaly, right? Really a large scale mistake. But what united people was a sense of mission that, you know, we're part of the Defense Department. We're supporting the war fighters or a combat support agency, and sort of that overrode a lot of dead ends that people could take, because you could have this very strong sense of ownership, right? We really are, we play an important role for the nation. We own this part of it and it's up to us. Again, we are, you know, obviously we're not a military combat support agency at CIS, but we're, you know, as Lee hinted, we have a very strong culture that's driven by, you know, it's a complicated world. It's a dangerous world. We have a special role to play here. And that lets you make up for a lot of, you know, maybe inefficient management by good people sort of taking charge and doing the kind of things that need to get done.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Lee, it's now with setting this tone, as it were, where have you then seen challenges coming in to where potentially security champions don't exist, or you're trying to engage a corporate culture to move into thinking about security? Because this is representatively, you mentioned it before, this is not an IT risk or a security risk, right? This is the shared responsibility. This is individual taking on personal responsibility. What do you see as some of the challenges and some of the ways you've overcome those?
Yeah, before I get to the challenges, you know, yep. Where I saw some turning points, and I don't know if Tony will agree or disagree on this, but prior to where we were really having a lot of data breaches, most people who worked in companies didn't really take security very seriously. And in fact, anytime I walked into a room full of C-suites or another department, you know, they gave me this look like, oh, he's here to make my life harder. That was kind of the mindset, that whatever you're going to do is going to make me have to take 10 more minutes to log in and things are going to be tougher. And where I saw a change in the last 20 years, I think, is when that data that was being breached was personal identifiable information. When the employees realized that, hey, that's my data, I need to do something, at least at the very least, not at home, but at least at work, I'm going to start taking it seriously. So I think there's been a good shift in organizations to start looking at it holistically like that. Now, where I do see some of the challenges, of course, one is staffing. And in cybersecurity, there's still huge gaps, even after 10, 20 years. There's just not enough resources to fill all these jobs that are out there. So I think the talent pool, when there's a shortage there, that affects really what you can do with it. You know, the biggest one, you still have that handful of employees that are resistant to change. They don't want to change. They want to find the shortcuts. They want to keep doing things the way they've always been doing them. And, you know, there's some mindsets there. But again, I'll go back to leadership engagement, because without that, it really falls apart very quickly. So it is a big top-down approach. And probably the last one, and I think we're all going through this right now as you know, the financial markets change based on politics or what's going on in the world, is really budget constraints. You know, do you have the budget to really elevate your security culture within the company? And I say there's some cost to it, because you're talking about, you know, phishing exercises and development of policies and procedures, the thing to build that culture. So if there's no budget for it, you know, that kind of falls off the plane right there. People don't focus on it again until a very long time.
Yeah, and that's a place, it's a great point, Lee, that, again, people will read the message and derive, you know, their rules of cultural behavior, right? They see no budget, then it obviously doesn't mean that much. And there, you know, that's a clear signal. But Jerry, you know, one of the things I think you've talked about, I call it something different. I call it the infrastructure of culture. You know, that is, again, in my experience, healthy companies that care about culture, you know what they want to be, and so they build an infrastructure, right? They hire for a certain set of sort of, I'll call it attributes. You know, people who have a certain mindset. They train to that. They, you know, align their personnel systems around all that, and then their executive decision making reflects that, right? They you can't just change a thing. You have to build an infrastructure that allows that, right? Which includes making it clear, having a clear budget for it. You know, it's not buried somewhere else, or it's not the first thing to get cut, and that kind of stuff. So, any good or bad examples? I think you've talked about them.
Thanks for asking, Tony. I've been waiting for you to say the M word.
Oh. Okay.
Mindset.
Ah.
Finally, we're about a half hour into this, and now we're going to start talking about how the rubber's going to hit the road, because that's really where it's going to be. You know, the idea, we've had this mindset now for more than 10 years. In some areas, it's been 20 years. And it has been the yellow sticky. It has been the, you know, users, end users, you know, let's not involve them because they'll probably break something or set something on fire. And we use this idea, well, we don't have enough people. We don't have enough money. We don't have that. Somebody this morning told me exactly why we have this problem with money. I thought it was funny. And it, guess where it came from? It came from NIST, of all places. And the idea was business risk comes from revenue and profit, and that's measurable. So, yeah, of course you got a budget because somebody's going to measure that budget on the other end. And the issue with security in terms of, you know, that is it's risk, and risk is not measurable. The biggest shortcoming developing a security culture is a lack of objective progress metrics to guide the effort. So if you can't measure it, it's like the story of the one-armed fisherman. One-armed fisherman is in the bait and tackle store, and the guy says, man, it must be really hard being a one-armed fisherman. And he says, no, it wasn't that bad at all. Last week, I caught a fish that big. So if you can't measure
it... We'll have to leave the audience who doesn't see you on screen to their imaginations, but we're all laughing. Thanks, Jerry.
Well, just imagine if you saw a one-armed fisherman and he said the fish was that big. I think they'll get it. And yes, it is a visual. But the idea is, I think it's time, and I'm just going to, you know, the big thing here is, I think it's time to transform our end users into first responders. That's what it's about. We need to develop a culture that gives them the individual responsibility, the idea of, wait, we're all going to do this? Everybody? Cybersecurity is everybody. It's not a department. It's not the boss. It's everybody. And I think I think mindset is where we need to go.
Yeah, I think the phrase I used back in the day, Jerry, was, and Sean, I believe you've read the book Cuckoo's Egg. And, you know, I mean, the classic, right? And the lesson I took from that, Cliff Stoll, the astronomer who spots, you know, literally pennies of fraud and you know, uncovers a huge espionage activity, that before I would say we want humans as your first responders, you really want them as your sensors. You know, humans are still, even in the, I have to plug AI at some point during the podcast, right, Sean? Isn't that a contractual requirement? Yeah. So even in the days of AI, we haven't figured out the technology that replaces the curiosity and cleverness of human beings. Thank heavens, right? We still have work to do that requires us humans. But that's the example of a human who was just bothered by a few pennies and was clever enough to knock down doors at multiple federal agencies, law enforcement and defense, until he got an answer. And that's just an astounding, but it was the role of the human as the sensor to spot something that we didn't have the technology to understand at that time. And I think that's, you know, there will be a place for that. I think, again, at least for the rest of my professional lifetime for a human. But let me share, when you talked about mindset, I got to do a story because Sean challenged me for a story. So I remember many, many years ago talking to an Army two-star, and this was in the early days of this. And so I'm at NSA. We got the red team, blue teams, and we're finding things. And there was a bad thing that happened. So we show up to try and help him out. And he goes, well, we need to find the person that failed to put in place the patch that left the enterprise at risk. And, you know, make an example of them. This is a command, whatever it was, issue. And I said, well, sir, with all due respect, and my dad was an Army sergeant. By the way, my dad was a Navy CB, Jerry, so during World War II. So I grew up in an enlisted family. But I'm talking to this two-star now. And I said, with all respect, sir, you do not have bad people. Yeah, you have bad strategy. In other words, if you put the fate of your entire enterprise in the hands of a 20-year-old tech school graduate, right, the least paid, least equipped, least informed member of your workforce, that's on you, me, the executives, not on that poor human being. And if that same human being had said, gee, sir, could we take down the mail server for a couple hours? We're way behind in patching it. We need to bring this thing up to snuff. It would be, no way, mission critical, right? You can't do that. So you're giving them conflicting requirements. You're equipping them in a space age fight with stone age tools. And the moment their enlistment runs up, they leave for industry at double or triple the price. This is bad strategy, right? So the expectations were out of line with the role. It was at Lee that talked about you know, you can't teach everyone to be a security expert. You have to sort of look at the role and the levers and responsibilities they have to work with. But that one, you know, and I made that one up on the fly, by the way, talking to this two-star. He didn't believe me, but I said,
Could we teach him to be a champion?
Well, I think he thought about it afterwards, and we were not close friends. I mean, this was a transactional thing, but I think he got the message later, right? That is, you can't throw this responsibility on this undertrained, underpaid member of your workforce. It was, in fact, you know, and part of the discussion that we had after that was about, you know, what are your expectations, right? What is reasonable for that, again, 20-year, literally a 20-year-old tech school graduate who's doing the best they can and under terrible conditions, right? Using fragile commercial technology basically to fight wars in sandy tents in the middle of a desert. What? Who thought that was a good idea? Not that 20-year-old kid, I promise you that. So I think getting people to see the bigger problem, right? Again, leadership, we get paid to kind of try to look at this whole infrastructure and, you know, make those big choices, but also identify what is the responsibility of every person in there. And am I clear about that? You know, and is there a responsibility I've given them appropriate to the tools and the role that they play? If not, you know, it's a leadership issue. It's not on that poor soul. I mean, people make mistakes, there's no question. But at the same time, we often throw things at them that are just out of whack. I'm sorry, Lee, I think you, I know this is personal to you because you lived in that life for so many years.
Yeah, you know, and it's also educational. I mean, the one thing we didn't really touch on a lot, a lot of people just don't know. You know, unless we take the responsibility of training our employees on the threats that they should be aware of, and what's even making it more convoluted now is we have all these emerging threats that are coming out, things that we've never seen before, and trying to, how do you educate your employees on those type of threats and the actions that they need to stop those type of things? So it's always continuous. The one last thing I just kind of want to remark when we were talking about the differentiation between corporate culture and a security aware culture within a company, they are distinctly different in what they're trying to achieve, but they're so highly dependent on each other. And one of the examples I wanted to give, you know, a few years ago, I used to do a lot of work in the crypto space for companies. And what I found providing security services to crypto companies is not the same as it is for financial services or something else. They're typically mostly engineers, developers. They got this. They know what's in their environment. They're secure. And they don't really have time to build a security culture. Or they're being funded by a VC or a private equity. And so it's that velocity that they've got to go after and kind of put security to the side for now. That's what I always hear, for now. But it never comes back around, even years later. So I think companies need to be cognizant of, number one, is what kind of company am I? Kind of the story of me, right? What's the story of my company? And what's the story of what we as a company are trying to achieve? And how does a security program or culture play into that business strategy?
And with that, we'll be right back after this quick break.
Operating systems in the cloud are vulnerable to malware, misconfiguration, and more. That is, unless you securely configure them. Enter the CIS hardened images. These virtual machine images come pre-hardened to the CIS benchmarks, providing built-in security and compliance you can trust. Available at less than 3 cents per compute hour, CIS hardened images save you time and money managing your cloud security posture. Available on all major cloud service platforms. So spin one up today by visiting cisecurity.org.
Thank you, and let's jump back into the episode. Jerry, with our final minute, you brought up such a great topic. What would be a single takeaway for our listeners based on today's topic that you would want to provide them?
It's time for a do-over. Now, you guys are going to see this, but nobody else is. I've got this little card called a do-over card. And my do-over cards, I'll send you one if I could find one. There it is. A do-over card. You're going to need one of these. And they lifetime, it's good for a whole lifetime. It'll last you forever. And basically, you just slam it on the table and you say, I declare a do-over. Matter of fact, there's two kinds of people in the world, status quo and growth. Which organization are you looking to create? You don't have to make a copy of your existing business structure, business culture. You can start all over and say, if we were going to make the best security culture, what would that look like? What could CIS help them with? Thank you so much for inviting me here today. And I can see within your own organization, if you all just stop in the hallway one day and say, wait a minute, we have a culture. Why don't we show other people how to do it?
That's excellent. Thank you, Jerry. That's very kind words.
Thanks for letting me on.
No, absolutely. Thank you. And thank you,
great.
Lee.
Love your insight.
Oh, go ahead, Lee, please.
I was going to say, thanks to Jerry. I really loved his insight.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And Tony, again, the storyteller supreme.
Well, life is full of funny stories, and I sometimes joke this.
Is that the last story Tony's going to tell us?
There's many more, but I'll save them for another day. But I will say,
for the next podcast,
I think of this as the business of failure. We always learn, but we have to fail first.
Exactly. Well, we're going to bring it to a close. Again, thank you to Jerry, Lee, Tony, as always, an absolute pleasure.
Back at you, Sean.
And like Jerry, please reach out. Questions, comments, concerns, thoughts for episodes and topics, podcast@cisecurity.org. And with that, join us in all the usual ways every Wednesday for episodes like this and much, much more. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today. The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.